This is Economics for Entrepreneurs, the podcast where we apply the principles of economics to help you start, grow, and manage your business. Here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. In our continuing effort to apply economics to help entrepreneurs to be successful, we come today to a topic that sounds esoteric but is actually fundamental. The economists call it capital theory. We entrepreneurs can call it business building. We'll see that how we select, allocate, manage, arrange, and rearrange capital determines our future profit streams. We need to think hard about it every day. We're going to have Per Byland with us today, and he is our expert in this field, so we'll be in good hands. Before he comes on, let's review the field with both our hats on, theory and practice. Let's start with the bad guys, or at least the useless guys in this case, mainstream economists. They offer no help in the area of capital. They like equations, and they like imaginary constructs like the production function to explain economic output, and they like to think about aggregates such as the economy. In their typical equation, capital is represented by the letter K and labor by the letter L, and they combine to produce an output, Q. Well, yeah, but that kind of abstraction is not going to get an entrepreneur very far. Economists of the Austrian school think differently. They realize that capital is located at the business unit level. That means you, the entrepreneur. They also realize that it's specialized. Every entrepreneur can have distinctive capital at the business unit level, and distinctive capital to perform different tasks. So that implies that if an entrepreneur is particularly clever or insightful or thoughtful at assembling distinctive capital, i.e. make sound investment decisions, greater success is possible. How does an entrepreneur pull this off? Via another distinctive method of Austrian economics, the careful process of economic calculation. To do that, we have to first differentiate between capital and capital goods. Capital goods are the diverse productive resources the entrepreneur assembles in his or her business. They can be tangible or intangible. Let's call it machines or recipes. And for our purposes, can include labor in the form of human capital. In order to compare the productivity of each of these diverse resources, we have to do capital accounting to turn them into money values that we can use to do economic calculation. So then we can compare machines to recipes using dollars. What's the dollar value of each of those items? Well, it's the money value of the assets, and that money value is calculated as the future streams of dollar income they produce. Capital is the source of income of a particular business. That capital can be owned or rented, although those two things are treated differently for accounting purposes. Our focus today is not on accounting, but on the mental balance sheet the entrepreneur keeps regarding the capital and combinations of capital available to his or her business, and the capital combinations that can be imagined for the future. How much income will they produce? How much income could they produce? Could they produce more? Will their productive earning capacity increase or decrease over time? If I rearrange them, will there be a different future revenue stream? And how do these assets produce income? Only to the extent that they create value or contribute to creating value for the consumer. In Austrian economics, only the consumer can create value. And consumers provide the income stream to the business by buying or not buying. Even if you're in a B2B business, the end consumer determines your income stream. You may make modem chips for phones and sell them to Apple, but if the consumer stops buying iPhones, your income stream dries up and the money value of your capital decreases. So an Austrian entrepreneur keeps an eye on capital differently and sees a balance sheet differently. We always have an eye on value creation, which means consumer perceived value, which means that we assess our assets entirely on their contribution to future revenue and net income streams coming from consumers. This is something we can do every day to assess the condition of our business. We ask the question, do we have the right capital combination for current and future income stream generation? Thus, like Austrian economics in general, capital is subjective. It's a mental construct, in this case, in the mind of the entrepreneur. At this point, let's bring in Dr. Bylund. Per is a fellow of the Mises Institute, an assistant professor of entrepreneurship, and Record Johnston Professor of Free Enterprise in the School of Entrepreneurship in the Spears School of Business at Oklahoma State University, and an associate fellow of the Ratio Institute in Stockholm. Per, hello.
Hi, Hunter. Good to be with you again.
Yes, thanks for joining us again. So today we're talking about Austrian capital theory and how that can help entrepreneurs. So I've pre-alerted our listeners to the subject in the preamble, but I'm sure my layman's summary is imperfect and it actually may not have been very clear. And since we believe in the principle that sound practice stems from sound theoretical understanding, I'd like to ask you to give an introductory summary of Austrian capital theory, and then we'll talk about how it guides the entrepreneur. So let's start with the theory.
Sure. So Austrian capital theory is unique in the sense that, and you already mentioned this, that Austrians see capital as heterogeneous. And this should be no surprise at all to entrepreneurs who, of course, know that a pin is not an automobile. But other economists apparently think that they're the same because they just consider the monetary value of each piece of capital, any type of machine or good. But because capital is heterogeneous.
Translate the word heterogeneous into regular language for people.
Sure. It means that it's varied and it's different. So heterogeneous capital being simply that everything is not shmoo or Play-Doh that you can create anything out of, but there are specific. I think Lockman talks about how capital goods have multiple specificities. I mean, that might not make it clear, but what that means is simply that any piece of capital, any type of tool, you can use it for several different things, but it's not endless or unlimited in how you can use it.
Okay,
it's very productive in certain uses, but of course you can use a hammer and a screwdriver in different ways. So that's the heterogeneity, that you have to pick a tool that is useful for whatever end that you're trying to attain.
Good. Sorry to interrupt. Please keep going.
Okay, so heterogeneity means that of course we can combine things as well. Now, I mean, I already mentioned the hammer and the screwdriver, and combining the hammer with nails is going to be a whole lot more productive than combining the hammer with screws. And the same thing with any machine, which consists of all these different types of components. And what this means is that you create these capital structures or these unique combinations of different types of tools and goods and machines and so forth. And you can view the whole economy as a specific capital structure that is always being adjusted by entrepreneurs, making investments, buying and selling goods and so forth, and combining them in new ways. But each firm is also a structure of capital. So when you start a business, maybe you need an office, maybe you need an automobile, maybe you need a couple of computers, maybe you need a couple of workers and so forth. And you combine them in a certain way. So you have the laborers, they have different roles, but then you have maybe a machine and you have offices in a certain manner and you have computers and certain software and all of these things so that they are all directed towards what it is that you are producing or expecting to produce. So you create this capital structure, you just combine these things and direct them in a sense, or as the research literature nowadays, they talk about the orchestration of capital, which I guess is a fancier word and sounds more positive as well. But this of course, what you're doing is also buying and selling goods, and you're realizing that you have more problems that you need to solve, or maybe you need to scale up and things like that, and then you need to invest in more capital. And scaling up doesn't mean simply that you're adding people and adding machines, but it might mean that you're instead investing in a different type of production technology that is much more scalable, or it's much more cost-effective at a higher volume. And that, of course, means that your internal capital structure changes, and so does the capital structure overall in the economy. So one way of viewing the entrepreneur is simply as that function in the economy that consistently adjusts all these means of production, this capital that we have available as a society, towards benefiting consumers.
Yeah, and we like the word orchestration, actually. We use it in service design a lot in business, and it's a nice image for the entrepreneur, I think. You don't have to play all the instruments, but you do pull them all together, and you do pull the right players together, and maybe you write the notes as well. So orchestration, I think, is a good analogy. But I'd like to pick up on something else you said, make sure that it's accurate from my perspective, that I understand it. The implication is that each entrepreneur can achieve a unique set of capital. He can assemble it in such a way, or she can assemble it in such a way, and polish it and hone it and refine it over time and trade it so it becomes unique and uniquely productive. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I mean, that is about the combination of capital, capital goods that you can procure in the market. But it also, you create your own processes. Maybe you develop specific skills or routines within your business that fit really well with the people who are employed by your business, and also the capital that you have accumulated, and also very specific towards the output that you're aiming for. That is, maybe you're producing a product that you need consumers to see or understand in a certain way. Maybe you have a brand that requires that they see it as more qualitative than other brands and so forth. So what goes on within your business should always be uniquely orchestrated towards that end, that, and maximize the value at the sort of the end point of that whole production process.
So we're talking about capital here as a very inclusive term, right? You've mentioned software, you've mentioned brand, you've mentioned processes, as well as assets like computers and cars and things like that. And so capital is what? Anything that is productive of value for an end consumer or an end customer it seems like a very inclusive term. Does it include labor, for example?
Well, it doesn't theoretically include labor, because theoretically speaking, capital has only one function in the economy, and that is to increase the productivity of labor. So in a sense, an investment in capital means that every labor hour expended creates more output. So any kind of tool or any kind of support for a production process that makes people more productive would be a form of capital. I mean, there are formal definitions of this as well, and there are several different ones. I tend to like Hayek's definition, where it says that, let's see, the capital are those non-permanent resources that permanently increase our productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds a little odd, maybe, but what it means by that is that the capital goods themselves, what they do is help us, I mean, on a society level, gain productivity and levels of productivity and the standards of living that were impossible before. And of course, we consume that capital by using it. And we know this. I mean, the more you use a machine, the more maintenance you need to invest in it to prolong the duration that it's useful. And you might need to invest in a new one because it's going to be old and break down and so forth. Right. So capital is not... it's not eternal, or you can't use it forever. But the idea is still there, and you can invest in prolonging the life of a piece of capital, and you can produce the same capital again. So since the idea is there, and you've already established that it does work in a sufficiently good way, and it does increase our productivity, that means that we have permanently increased our standard of living and the productivity of the economy.
So if I'm an entrepreneur, Per, I'm still thinking in terms of putting the right combination of labor and capital together. And maybe my capital includes training, for example, that helps the folks in my workforce give better consumer service or do the job better or something like that. So the processes and methods of training and upgrading labor, I might consider those in my capital. Is that fair?
I think so. From an entrepreneur's point of view, I mean, it doesn't really matter if we talk about what is theoretically capital and what is theoretically labor. What matters is that you need means of production in general to help you produce whatever it is you want to sell to your customers, whether consumers or other businesses. And of course, then you have the choice between capital and labor, those categories, but you also have the choice between different types of machines. You have the choice between different types of routines within your business and different types of organization, different types of strategies, different types of education of your workforce and your employees and so forth. So all of those decisions are really the same. They're all aiming towards increasing the productivity, that is increasing the number of goods that you can produce for a certain cost, right? So you want to increase the output for the same input or as little input as possible.
Yep. And as I understand it in Austrian capital theory, that we measure that output as a money value. It's the flow of revenues or net revenues that we receive from customers and consumers as a result of deploying that capital in the right way. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the only way of calculating whether your business actually is doing a good job and whether it's actually contributing to our standard of living overall is to compare money in and money out. Mm-hmm. And if you get more money in, your revenue are higher than the money out, your cost, then you make the difference. That is their profit. And that profit really signals that you're using all those inputs, the capital and the labor and so forth, in a more productive way than other entrepreneurs figured was possible. So that's sort of the simplistic way of viewing the business, that whatever it is you're doing, you need to at least break even, right? That you're producing as much value as you use producing it. But even better is, of course, to make a profit, which means that you have supplied consumers with a value that is not reflected in the prices of those inputs. So other entrepreneurs have not discovered how to use those inputs in such a valuable way.
Yep. So let's try and get a little bit more practical now, Per. Let's get into the mindset of an entrepreneur. Let's say I have a business. It's producing a net revenue flow now. I've got capital goods in the forms of machines like computers, as you said. I've got some rented assets like my office space. I've got software. Maybe I've rented some. Maybe I've built some software, but it's software that I can deploy. I've got employees and I've got a cost to them, employee benefits and so on like that. I've got some methods and processes. And I want to assess whether I've got the right combination of assets and whether I can make that combination better in terms of the future net income flows or profit flows that it delivers. How do I go about doing that? Is there a method for assessing my capital combination to see if it's the best it can be?
Well, I'm not sure there is such a thing as the best that it can be. I mean, you can always combine capital in a different way and pursue a different type of market or maybe innovate a different type of product that has not existed before and so forth. But what you want to avoid is wasteful use of resources. So maybe one way of thinking about it is to see, do all these parts that you consider necessary, or at least that you considered necessary, that are now part of your production process, do they actually contribute to value at the end of the production process? Because if they do not, they might be improve convenience or comfort and might provide you with sort of feel good in the business, but they do not actually provide value to the consumer. So that's the way of thinking about it. We've had this discussion several times before when we said the customer needs to be your focus. The value for consumers, that's how you stay in business and that's how you are in business. And that's how you need to think about each of the resources as well. Does this specific capital good or this specific employee, in a sense, in this position contribute to value for consumers? And if they do not, then you can probably move that person or that piece of capital to be used in a different way in the business. And maybe then that person or that capital good can contribute to the bottom line.
Yeah. But one of the thoughts that came to me, and we touched on this earlier, I think, was there's a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot of, there's some progress in business towards not having an office building, having everybody work remotely. There are people like FlexJobs and Mozilla and Articulate that have no centralized employee location. And maybe you could say, hey, an office building doesn't contribute to consumer value at all. It doesn't matter where people work. And so therefore, they might look at that asset, the cost of renting the building or owning it if they own it, and say, it's not contributing to value. We don't need it. Let's cut it out. So maybe is that one way we could proceed, is root out those assets that don't contribute to consumer value?
Yes, that's exactly right. And very often, entrepreneurs tend to think in terms of control, that they want to control all their assets just in case something happens. And that's understandable because there's a lot of uncertainty running a business. But at the same time, you should be able to trust the market by simply procuring whatever services you need, because that means that you can immediately get rid of them if you don't need them anymore. And what you mentioned, an office, is exactly that type of thing. I mean, you can instead of buying a building, and owning property, which generally earns you a pretty poor return. And owning property simply to have an office, that doesn't make much sense at all. You should view it as an investment instead. And can you do something that earns you a greater return with that money than buying your office? You probably can. And if you can, you should stay away from buying that office building. You should instead rent an office, or even better, not have an office at all. I mean, nowadays you can use modern information technology. And if you don't actually need all your employees to sit in one place, I mean, if you have a store, it's pretty obvious that you need people in the store, and you need the store as well because customers show up in your store. But if you're providing a service online, say, there's no reason why your employees need to sit together, unless you think that there are such synergies, such benefits from them sitting together that it's worth it. But it might best be the case that they're just as productive or almost as productive working from home remotely. And if that is the case, you shouldn't even rent an office.
Right. So that's one step. Let's root out assets that don't contribute to consumer value. Another one that we might explore, for example, you talked about combinations of assets, and maybe there are combinations that can do better if they're rearranged. So an example might be a trained person plus a computer plus software is a productive asset combination, but perhaps I want to invest more in the person and the software and less in the computing power. So I get rid of my computers and I use computing power from Amazon Web Services. And I find that helps me invest more in training people and it's more productive. So can renting assets, in this case, computing power, be a way to get that flexibility of combination that I can fine tune and make better over time?
Absolutely. And in a sense, a way of thinking about the firm is that you're doing something that you couldn't do without the firm. And it's not really efficient from the point of view of the economic system, unless you can, if you can contract it out and in that sense use market prices and use contracting with others, you should. because that means that you're very flexible. You can cut those ties and end those contracts at a moment's notice, perhaps. And you're not burdened by that cost. But of course, that means that you have to consider what is the actual value of your business. What is it that you're actually providing? But the more you can rent, the more you can outsource, the better it is, because it's easier for you to control those costs. And it's also easier, but when you start outsourcing, it's easier to see what you get for those costs. It's much easier to understand that you might not actually get a whole lot out of that extra computing power if you pay for it every month. But if it's a down payment and you buy a bunch of computers and then people sit there using them, it's not as easy to see whether they actually make a difference. So that's the reason to outsource, because you can play different suppliers against each other and get the price down quite a bit, probably get it cheaper than you could in-house. But you can also control the cost, and you can see what the cost actually contributes to the bottom line. So in a sense, the golden rule for an entrepreneur should be to have as little as possible in-house.
Yeah, and doesn't that have implications for organization as well, Per, that have as little in-house as gives you that dynamic flexibility that we are looking for, but also having a decentralized organization where the people closest to the assets and with the best training for the assets can deploy them in the right way. I think the language is that you have decision rights and knowledge co-located. And if that's at the bottom of the organization, that's a good place for it. Does that form a part of how we create these new or these unique capital combinations?
Yes, I think so. And I mean, that would be the precursor to outsourcing. I mean, you might need to start by directing the whole organization and all of the production process. And entrepreneurs usually do that. They start the business and the founder is sort of involved in everything, micromanaging and contributing to everything. And then you start hiring people, you scale up a little bit, you buy machines to free up labor time to do other things. But then your overhead starts to increase as well, and you get more and more costs, and it gets harder and harder to understand what is actually a productive use of all this money that you're investing in the organization. And the more you can push down these decisions and let your employees, in a sense, play self-employed in your business. I mean, they make the decisions. They get sort of a decision space that they control themselves, and they have the tools to carry out their job or their job tasks. And the next step would be to simply say, hey, well, you don't only have to play self-employed, but you can be self-employed. I'll buy your services from you. And whenever I need to change my business or sales is slow or whatever, then I'll let you go, basically, as you can do with a subcontractor. So, I mean, that's part of the whole process, going from very centralized, sort of a blob where you can't really tell which piece contributes to the bottom line, because everything is a big mess in a sense. But you think that everything is necessary, even though it's probably not, and you're probably not using the resources in the best way possible. And then from there, try to structure things and decentralize as much as possible. And eventually you outsource.
But one of the implications of what you said is that I am trying to help employees make themselves as valuable as possible to create these future revenue streams by making decisions autonomously or semi-autonomously at the edge of the organization. And in fact, if they do well, they can be entrepreneurial themselves. They can make themselves more valuable. So I'd probably rather do that than automate them out of a job or outsource them out of a job. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the best way for for them to become that productive and for you as an entrepreneur to help them is to make them think of themselves as suppliers to the firm rather than employees in the business. They are suppliers of knowledge and time and effort and skill and so forth to the production process in the business. And the more they think of themselves like that, the more they realize what they should focus on and what they probably should not do, because that doesn't actually contribute to their customer, but it's the employer. And if it contributes to the customer, that should contribute also to the firm's customer, that is the consumer.
Yeah, I think that's a great way that Austrian economics can contribute to this whole idea of individuals taking responsibility for their own value. And they can do that inside the firm or outside the firm, but we can help them do that in both ways. Let me ask a question that makes sure that we haven't talked ourselves into a trap here, which is if we think of this firm that we're running, we're renting computing power, we've eliminated our office space, we've got just-in-time logistics by fulfillment by Amazon, and Alibaba's got our production chain going in Asia. Our capital is as flexible and non-fixed as possible. I'm capital light. Does that mean I've reduced the capital value of my firm?
Well, you have reduced the value of the capital in your firm for sure. The firm itself should be valued only by the expected future profits. So I don't think the capital, even though it's often the case that when you value a business, you look at the balance sheet and you look at, okay, so what are the assets, what are the liabilities and so forth. And that's a good start. But those assets are really only worth their contribution to the bottom line, not actually the sort of the accounting value, because that doesn't really matter. So in that sense, it doesn't matter if you own the capital or not. The reason we can use accounting as sort of a rule of thumb for the value of the business is that we're simply assuming that you would not have capital in-house. You would not own that capital were it not for that capital to contribute sufficiently to the bottom line. But of course, this is an assumption that is sort of in line with mainstream economics and equilibrium thinking, that you might have capital assets that do not really contribute much to the bottom line. And those assets should not be on your balance sheet. They're more of a liability, really, on the value of your business than they are an asset, I would say. They don't contribute to the expected profits of the business.
Yeah, and you can look at big companies like GE, which is currently going through that process of realizing that they've got assets on their books that aren't producing those future revenue streams, and there are huge transaction costs in trying to rearrange that balance sheet. So that's real life at the big corporation.
Absolutely.
We've had a couple of instances in venture capital where you look at the sales of companies when they're acquired, and you can see that the amount of market value that's been created, the price they sell for, compared with the amount of investment that has been put in them is a very high multiple. And so that's a market example, is it not, of exactly what we're talking about. We can create a lot more market value for a low level of capital value.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about this a number of times, and I think it's worthwhile to repeat again that what really matters in your business and for the business and for the value of the business too is whether it contributes to and is expected to contribute to consumer satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So if you produce value for consumers and people expect you to produce value for consumers, then the value of the business is going to be much higher than if you have a bunch of capital, say, on the books, but you don't produce much value to the consumers.
Right. And so that brings us to another point that's fundamental in our Austrian analysis, which is uncertainty. We're talking about future revenue streams, future income streams coming from consumers, and we may project those over time to try and figure out the value of our assets. And so the duration becomes involved, but revenue streams don't go on forever. and we've got to make assumptions about the duration of those flows. Is there any advice to entrepreneurs about making that calculation? Again, in venture capital, we look at the cash flow plan, and we compare that with funding availability. And when it's negative, it's called the burn rate. We're losing money, and we look at the time to cash flow break even. But there's not a lot of accuracy in those calculations, frankly. We're able to compare actual with estimates and make adjustments. But can we generalize from that? What's the best way for entrepreneurs to think about those future revenue streams and their durations? How do they manage that?
Well, that's where the entrepreneurial judgment comes in. I mean, it's really the role of the entrepreneur to try to figure out how to create value and how to make sure to get customers to pay for whatever it is you're producing. So, I mean, what would you say about cash flows that are expected in the future? That's totally uncertain. You can't know. You can be undercut by a competitor that comes out of left field that you had no idea of, and that could be any day. And it could be the case that maybe you produce something that suddenly becomes a fad, so that you have millions of customers bidding over each other to get your product. You can't know that either. So, I mean, what the only thing you can do is use your judgment, and even better. And what you mentioned about venture capitalists, that is really to this point, that the more people involved in making the judgment, people who think about these issues and understand these issues, then you start to sort of weed out errors that you've made in your thinking. So we talked about before about sort of testing hypotheses and things like that. But also what we talk about in this podcast about understanding how the economy works and understanding people. That's what you need to base your judgment of the future on. Have you positioned your goods in the best way possible? Can you position them differently? Can you sort of produce a different narrative around your goods so that they appear more valuable for consumers? That is also creation of value. Mm-hmm. That will increase your cash flow as well.
Right. Yeah, it's often called consumer loyalty, but that makes it sound very robust, and it's far more fragile than that in real life, I think. So just one question about this accounting for future revenue flows. The managerial accounting, the accounting that goes on in the entrepreneur's economic calculation, is different than the financial accounting that presents data to tax authorities and other authorities. So there are formal accounting processes and standards that are applied to reporting. But I think we're saying the entrepreneur's subjective calculation of market value, it's a different kind of accounting. It's somewhat subjective. She or he's got to keep that thinking in her head somehow. Is that right? Can you comment on that? How do I keep those two forms of accounting separate and not get fooled by what's written down in the accounting reports compared to what's going on in the marketplace?
Yeah, in a sense, I think entrepreneurs should simply not bother with reading financial statements, especially their own, for the simple reason that financial statements are really based off of, in a sense, the estimated market value of the resources. But what you're doing as an entrepreneur and what you refer to as managerial accounting is really take those market value of all those capital goods in your business and the market value of the employees and everything like that. And you need to create more value than that. It's that easy, right? Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you would simply sell your resources and you would make more money than if you run your business. So that is just sort of the starting point. That's the basis. You need to create more value than all those resources are worth in your business. So it's you can look at the financial statements, but I don't think that helps you very much. What you should do instead is think about consumers. Think about how you can provide value for consumers. That is basically talk to them, find them, figure out how they live their lives, what they might want in their lives, and what this what would be a valuable good or service for them, and then provide them with it.
and ask them to pay a price for it, of course, but to make sure that you get revenue. And their financial statement should not be anything else but simply something that hunts you and makes sure that you produce more value than that.
Good. So I think we've reached the point where we give in to the clock here. And I hope we've helped entrepreneurs here to think about every day they're looking at their combinations of capital or capital and labor and trying to adjust them for their best function in generating future revenue flows from the consumer. So maybe you can sum that up better than I can on the subject of capital and economic calculation and dynamic flexibility. So let me allow you to do that.
Well, I think the best way of thinking of capital is simply to see them as ways of producing and see them as contributions to producing some value in the minds of consumers. And always rethink the structure of your business and rethink how you do things and with what you do things. Because you can always, I think the more you learn about consumers, the more you learn about the people that you have employed, as well as the technologies and so forth, and learn from your competitors as well, the more you can adjust how you do things. And that's anything from investing in a new machinery or a different machinery, training your employees or hiring more people or hiring different people, updating your routines, all of these things. Anything should be on the table, really, in trying to figure out how to create more value using the costs of the inputs in your business.
Yeah, and that's Hayekian term, I think, of non-permanent ways to permanently increase productivity becomes very pertinent. It's not only non-permanent, it's highly flexible and dynamic. I think that's your message, isn't it? To keep very agile, flexible, and dynamic in thinking about your capital combinations.
Absolutely. I mean, that is your role, right? The whole economy consists of a whole lot of production processes, but all these production processes use capital in one way or the other. And your role as an entrepreneur is to figure out a way of using that capital that exists in even better ways. So if you can produce more value using the same capital compared to other entrepreneurs, then you're basically a good entrepreneur and you will make a profit.
Good. Well, thank you, Per. Let's leave it there. We appreciate your expertise and guidance and helping us build this bridge from Austrian capital theory to practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Hunter. Always good to talk to you.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.